Hey, what's going on? This is the Educated Guest Podcast, and I'm Justin, your host. Hey, if this is your first time listening, then thank you for taking the time to join in this movement. Most people who tune in regularly are artists and designers who are seeking a transformational style of education. So if you're someone currently looking to start a studio, or you're pursuing a career as a full-time artist, or just trying to get the job of your dreams, then you are in the right place. The good news is that there is some method to the madness. We're not just randomly talking about things. We have three episode types, which includes our well-known series of dialogues entitled Well Read. Our three segments collectively answer questions regarding personal development, professional practice, and artistic inspiration. I'm really excited to announce this week's guest. His name is Robert Newman. He's a friend of mine who I've known for a long time. He's a 2014 Morehouse graduate from Little Rock and currently residing in New York City. I think the most curious part about this conversation is the way that we dig into the meaning behind the work. And I'm really enjoying that about the more recent conversations I've been able to share with you all, is that we get into the details of what the pieces mean. And we get to hear perhaps like a little bit of an artist's response to what we perceive and see if it matches up and see what we've maybe gotten wrong and what we've gotten right. In particular, our conversation with Robert goes into detail about how Little Rock has influenced him, which you'll hear right off the bat. But we also get into the details of how he learned to build up the muscle of creativity. If you go through his work and look through the website, which I highly encourage that you do, you'll find a consistent language and you'll find a consistent output that speaks to a certain mindset, a certain mentality about a life lived in a certain way and a history that belongs to only him. I think you'll love what he has to say.
I want to talk about Little Rock, and the question is simply, how has your upbringing in Little Rock influenced your perspective?
My time in Little Rock is ironic, I think, for the name of the city, because it was like super foundational. Growing up, both my parents were in the military and neither one of them was a stranger to moving around a lot. And I really didn't like give account to how much I moved until somebody asked me maybe like how many schools I had gone to, or vice versa. Somebody told me like K through 12 or something like that. They went to the same school. And if I counted up, I think I've gone to like maybe 7 or 8 schools between like pre-K and 12th grade. So some of those are like big moves. Some of those are small moves. But Little Rock was a place that always kind of centered and focused my mom's side of the family. And as a artist, as an adult, as a person just like trying to go through life, I've kind of, let's say, mapped like some of my bigger influences back to certain sides of my family, certain family members. And Little Rock was really the place where I think the Afrocentricity kind of like set in. I was able to, first of all, like that's where my mom's side of the family is from. So Little Rock as a place is just very Main Street America, very black and white. And if there was any reminder that you ever needed or anybody else needed in terms of like the country's sordid past, Little Rock is a great place to go to just visibly see like this is where black people stay, this is where white people stay. This is how black people think about their community. This is how white people think about their community. This is how everybody thought about size and in the Civil War. Little Rock is home to like the Little Rock Nine. And one of the funny small things about Little Rock that people don't know is that it's randomly violent as well. HBO did this special called Banging in the Rock. And apparently there was like this reverse migration process that happened as black people were going from the South to the Midwest to the North to get away from everything. Somehow, once gangs picked up in California, those gangs like kind of migrated back to Arkansas. So imagine a community that again, doesn't really have a lot of opportunity, doesn't really have a lot of economic freedom, and is already kind of racially charged, mixed in with more of these random elements. So that's a backdrop. And then some of the good parts, Little Rock was a place where I kind of got close to that issue of blackness, but also got close to the brilliance of it too. So I was in a band when I was younger, and the band that my schools always modeled after was UAPB. So unbeknownst to me, like, that was my first exposure to HBCUs. When I got old enough, I went to this pre-college program, upward bound program called Philander Smith College, another HBCU. And through that experience, I was able to do a college tour that actually brought me to New York. So Little Rock ends up being really random. It's not my favorite American city by far, but when it comes to like just how I was developed as an artist, as a person, it is, again, the name is ironic, but it's like the bedrock to the entire situation.
So it sounds like, first of all, I appreciate how fluidly you were able to articulate its impact on you. Most times when we're like called upon, when our introspective nerve is called upon, it doesn't necessarily respond immediately. So I appreciate the fact that you were able to tap into that. And the irony in the name is interesting alongside the geographic area. Mm-hmm. And I want to go there for a second, because not only is there this migration of gang activity, but there's also this history of the Great Migration up the Mississippi River. Mm-hmm. And every city along the Mississippi is like a remnant of that history. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you even, Arthur Java talks a lot about his family history and family ties in the Mississippi Delta, and sort of that being all the way down to Louisiana as the, or more so like Biloxi, I guess, mm-hmm. that being like one of the foundational roots. And like, again, it's like the Mesopotamia of blackness,
yeah,
in the modern sense or contemporary sense. And I'm curious about any desire you might have to return there, and if that is a desire of yours to return and do some work there.
Yeah, it's an idea I grapple with a lot. I mentioned earlier that it kind of represents to me everything that Main Street America is. So being in Harlem now, it's a bit of a reprieve that I'm like on Wall Street. I get to walk around and see more or less some of the, I don't even want to call it glitz and glam, because it's also the grit of the city as well. But all those things that we think about in terms of America in an ideological sense. Cities, mostly liberal, but at the very least argumentative. People are very vocal. They use the First Amendment well here. Any issues that come up, people take to the street, and before we get to any like political engagement or environment, like it seems like folks are generally well informed and like have some stakes in the matter that you really have to consider. But by the time we talk about America from a sense of like Arkansas, I'm just thinking about like how backwards is a strong word, but it's hard to get away from. It's like, how do we really move ourselves forward from here? I've heard somebody describe society as like a convoy. And the reason why things move so slow is because we're not trying to be at the fleeting edge, such that we're pushing and growing and innovating, but we're really trying to make sure that the slowest vehicle doesn't fall out of formation. And thinking about it like that, I mean, it seems like a lost cause, but there's hope. I have it like kind of very, very as a Hail Mary right now in my mind. Like, I don't think about it on the daily, but maybe 50-ish years out, 30-ish years out, I could see myself going back Recently, I purchased a family home with my mom. So whether I want to or not, like I now have property in Little Rock. So I'll be going back for that. And again, I think just because of like the tie into like my story, whether I go back to stay or not permanently, there's always going to be like some part of me that is invested in it.
There's two things that makes me think about. The first is this idea of future favoring the liberal. Mm-hmm. And I have really no like political ideals or political aspirations with what I'm about to say, but it is mm-hmm. sort of a truth of history that you look at something as simple as like Medicaid and Medicare. These were radical ideas at the time, but they've almost become to be norms of mm-hmm. of conservative party, of a conservative mindset now, which is like, I work hard, I should have this. But the only reason we have this is because at a certain point, someone took the risk to say, look, man, like this is a forward-thinking idea. Even the idea of welfare, which is still a liberal idea in the capitalist sense, is something that at some point was an extremely liberal concept. So I'm bringing this up for the sole purpose of acknowledging what you were saying about America trying to innovate and mm-hmm. largely being either held down to the standards of its lowest version of itself mm-hmm. while also trying to stretch to the highest version of itself. And I think what we're experiencing is that stretching, and it's hard to sort of find your place in the stretching version of America. And I think a lot of people are feeling that tension. And the second thing I wanted to say was with regard to this idea of a Mecca in terms of your experience in New York. And you mentioned this idea of glitz and glamour. And I'm curious about how this might tie into a piece I want to talk about. I've never really do this. I've done this a whole lot of times, as you know, and it takes a while to get into the work, but I feel that your piece Welcome to Eden is somewhat related to this idea of it's related to the glitz and glamour to me from a stance of seeking and perhaps finding. And what you found is hard to represent. So without me tainting what the piece is actually about, maybe we can like spend some time with you describing that a little bit more.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. And it's actually a really good, I guess, tangent from our conversation about Little Rock, because the Welcome to Eden piece was inspired by a friend of mine, an alpha brother, and he came to me with the question or with the thought, how can we, one, tell his personal family history, but also tell a grander story about Black people's migration to the North? So his story, very similar to a lot of ours. His family started in, I want to say in the Carolinas, and now they're mostly centered within Long Island. And they mind that gap that you're talking about, going back and forth between these two places. And he's really a part of like that first generation with millennials and Gen Z, where I think Black people are starting to really either experience wealth for the first time or be the recipients of just generational wealth in just large numbers. The piece Welcome to Eden was, I think, depending on how you look at it, it was supposed to be two stories, like legitimately two different takes on it. On the one hand, Welcome to Eden, the piece, the name even suggests like we're looking for a promised land, right? And we were able to actually find the thing that we were seeking, right? There were some interesting elements in the picture that that I ended up favoriting, and that's why they stand out, I think, a little bit more
For example, the character, the female character in the painting has a lemon in her hand. And I think there was something funny about that to me that, you know, anytime we think about this forbidden fruit, it's always an apple. But this quote, this idea, like, you know, when life hands you lemons. So I like that just funny switch. And for the guy, the Adam character in there, he's playing the piano. And I want to say it was Peggy Lee. This is a song that she has that she talks about. I think the name of the song is That All There Is. It's a bit morbid, but essentially she's just saying, like, if life is always gonna throw you the hook, you know, let's just keep dancing. And I thought that was a nice symbol for the man to sit there at the piano. Like, so while we're on this journey, like, there's always this element of music and flair and soul. And in the actual piece, like, when you see it, there's a lot of texture involved. There's a lot of gold. There's a lot of highlights. So very literally, I wanted to kind of translate on the canvas this idea of like El Dorado. Or when we think about New York, like a city that's like streets paved in gold. Mm. Now going back to this irony, like this juxtaposition, the centerpiece of the painting that actually says "Welcome to Eden" on the actual image, Eden is spelled incorrectly. And the reason being is because, I don't know, like for somebody that wanted to read into it or was able to maybe hear this interview and go back and take a look, it's this idea that even on the journey, there's going to be like some pit stops that we make it to, and there's still further to go. Like no matter how, let's say, comfortable the first spot is. So in that painting, you see there's a valley that they're in as they're walking towards the city. But once you see the city, there's also another mountain in the background. I heard somebody, I guess last point there for like that valley and that mountain situation, I heard somebody kind of give the anecdote around Moses leaving Egypt. And they asked the question, what if Moses parked right on the other side of the Red Sea? Would that have been the answer to the story? Like, you're out of bondage, you've gone through your first miracle, and now here you are, free and in your own city. And it's funny, because when you think about that, it's like, well, no, because if you were right on the other side of the sea, obviously, like, Pharaoh will come get you. So this idea for, like, welcome to Eden, it's like, well, where is Eden? And how far do we really have to go to get to that promised land or to get to that mountaintop?
First of all, I love that. I love and this is a question I'm going to have in a second around the concept of abstraction. And I don't want to lead into that question too fast. So I'll stick to this one that says, this piece, the reason I want to talk about it is because it reminded me a whole lot of Carl Jung. Mm-hmm. And it reminded me a lot of his work in the Red Book. And what he's trying to depict is this idea of the marrying and the marriage between chaos and order. Mm-hmm. And when I saw this, it took it a step further, because chaos and order are not the only things we're dealing with at all times. Like, I think that it's tough to like just reduce life to those two factors, given all the different things that are going on. So when you try to, it would be like trying to pull up to a friend who's having a panic attack and saying, look, man, like all you need to do is just realize that you're in a state of chaos right now, and we just need to get some order. And those are only two factors. And it's like, bro, like there's so much more going on here. And the thing I love about this idea of Eden being a referential point for coming from a Black artist is that, you know, Judeo-Christian ideals finding their way back into Afrocentricity, and where the two meet is probably the most interesting storyline I can think of, because mm-hmm. the two aren't meant to meet. And they actually have quite a violent introduction to one another. But the fact that you were able to reconcile that with beauty, with color, and not necessarily talking about the violence of those two things intersecting, but more so talking about the universal truth of those two things. Whether you're Afrocentric or Christian, the truth is still the same. And that's what I loved about even the misspelling. The misspelling give hints at that. They're like, there is no Eden as you know it, or as you thought about it, or as it was promised. So just some thoughts, man. That's a beautiful piece to me. That's why I really wanted to get that on record, that maybe what I thought it was about was what it was actually about. And turns out it's even more than I thought. So that's super cool. The next thing I wanted to go to was this idea of abstraction. Like I mentioned, I'm not going to read the entire quote from Kerry James Marshall, but I'll do my best attempt to summarize it. And there might be some people listening who know me and they're like, you didn't do a good job. And I was like, oh, whatever. but anyway, on several occasions, Kerry James Marshall talks about his body of work in terms of the representation of the Black figure and it's how the Black figure occupies space.
Yeah.
And essentially, for those listening, he states, and again, this is not verbatim, so you can go and research what we're talking about. He states that it's assumed that most Black artists are supposed to abstract the Black figure away from how it's actually exists in reality in order to gain uniqueness. Therefore, which is to say, like, if you just paint the Black body as it is, the Black body as it is not interesting enough to the public to get you any worthwhile notoriety. So you need to abstract it in order to be relevant. And it got me thinking about this line of like this lineage of abstract expressionist artists that sort of come from the Basquiat, that come from even, I know it's not Black artists, but even from the Pollock range. Like you see a lot of Black artists who are not classical artists. They are in all intents and purposes, like abstract expressionists. And I'm curious about your take on Black art and its relationship to abstraction from reality.
I was just watching some interviews with the artist you mentioned, and I mean, personally, that one resonated with me a lot. I do a lot of work outside of the actual artwork that I do, but I guess in the corporate arena, in diversity and inclusion. And this idea of taking up space or showing up in space or really storytelling in a way that's explicit is something that we don't think about in terms of freedom. It's something that, I don't want to say oppressed people, but I mean, marginalized folks or folks that generally aren't in power or folks that are for whatever reason just ismed and put into a hierarchy, that click does not always occur where we think about code switching, where we think about dulling down of language, where we think about being less offensive in order to be polite or affable in a room of our peers. And that subtle translation every single time loses meaning. It dilutes expression. And then, I mean, it really does dilute, I think, that authenticity piece and what artists are trying to get across. Now, that's not me to say, I don't think that people who are more abstract or more expressionist in their painting can't convey the same messages. But I think what Kerry James Marshall is trying to say is that it's important, at least when we think about the artifacts and the canon of Black art, like what is that entire story telling us and what is the art meant to do? That representational work is kind of critical. Like when we go into all of our institutions now that for lack of, I mean, better vocabulary, like hold the reins on the human story, the human art experience, the human cultural the cultural body of work. You go in those places like the MoMA, the Met, the Whitney, and 9 times out of 10, again, you're going to get some of that abstract work. You're going to get some of that modern expressionist work. You're not going to see, one, work from Black artists, and then two, Black artists. Like, you're not going to see Black art. You're not going to see Black people. You're not going to see Black faces. And maybe I take it too personal, but that's, to me, just another way of, at least in the art arena, that's another way of, like, oppression. That's another way of, like, silencing a story. And I think this happens with Black artists across the board, not just painters. We end up getting overly critical with, say, like, the specific execution, simply because what I believe is, like, just a law of small numbers. So I think they call it, like, the curse of being first, right? Obama is the worst Black president we've ever had. Like, he should have been more for Black people. He should have been less for Black people. Mm. He should have listened to hip hop. He should have not listened to hip hop. Like, until we get 100 Black presidents, like, Obama is going to be the one that we critique the most. With music, it's the same. With acting, it's the same. With Black art, it's the same. And, like, every time Gary comes out and, like, talks about this, I think that's what it is. And he's just saying, like, okay, of all the things that we can be doing right now, I'm not saying that people shouldn't be painting, but I'm going to paint these Black faces because it's useful. It is a direct answer to a question. Where are we? What have we been doing? And why have we been doing it? And I don't want people to even remotely think of this as abstract.
Mm. Yeah, man. You know, the idea of the curse of being first, I never heard it said that way. I've heard a lot of stuff. I've never heard it said that way. So that's beautiful. And the idea of representation in its reality reminds me of the other pieces that I selected to talk about, The Big Dreams and My Favorite Hue. More so My Favorite Hue than anything, because not only is it just, I mean, as I understand it, it's a collection of artists presented in a certain light, particularly Black artists. And the first person you chose was Nipsey. Mm-hmm. And the second person, I believe the second, or maybe the third, was Chance. Mm-hmm. And to see these artists in a certain light is something new. It's almost like it begs the question of when's the last time that, our families took a family portrait, and how important is the family portrait? Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, you know, presidents have a certain, you know, they have a portrait that's documented in time. Every time we see John F. Kennedy, we see the same picture of him. Mm-hmm. Every time we see, you know, Einstein, we see the same pictures of them. And as a brief aside, you know, more so kind of maybe showing my hand a little bit here, but I remember, Kanye was on a tweeting rant or something like that a while back. One of them, I forget which one it was, but he said something in the middle of all the nonsense where he was talking about, and it was nonsense. I don't want to color what he's saying is nonsense. That's not something I'm interested in doing. He said something that was with regard to Phil Knight and Michael Jordan. And he said, look, Phil Knight don't even have to show his face, but Michael Jordan got a smile on his picture. And last time I checked, Phil Knight never had to jump from the free throw line. And that just resonated with me because it brought about this larger question about representation across different lines and how we present ourselves and how we have to present ourselves to be welcomed into a larger society. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious about whether any of what I just said is related to My Favorite Hue.
I'll start with a joke. I think you'll appreciate with that, especially with that Kanye tweet. I always get the feedback that I should smile in my ID pictures for passports, for driver's license, for work. And for driver's license especially, when people tell me like, well, why don't you smile? Why weren't you dressed up? Blah, 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 blah. Like my grandma actually makes an appointment to do this. So she is very specific. She updates her picture like once every like 3 years, makeup, hair, everything. And anytime people ask, I'm like, I only show my ID in situations where I would not be smiling. Like if I get pulled over, I'm not smiling. I don't even want to dilute the experience. Like, sir, do you know why I stopped you? Hands on my ID, smiling picture of black man. I'm like, no. I want it to look the exact same. So if I have a straight face, here's my straight face. This is me. This is what I look like. So yeah, when we talk about like representation and my favorite hue, the series was actually named after that painting. I had a Spelman sister reach out to me and say, wow, you know, my favorite hue is Nipsey Blue. And I was like, okay, the catchiness of it stuck. And then when I thought about deeply into like my favorite hue, I'm like, oh, well, I mean, of course my favorite hue is black. It's black and like all colors and all dimensions and all shapes and all sizes. Like I'm like fascinated in it at this point. Growing up, doing as much traveling as I did, I've been in Florida, I've been in Arkansas, I've been in Tennessee, I've lived in Georgia, lived in Oklahoma. So touched all like corners of the South. And in my traveling, I think I've maybe hit at least like 28 or 29 states so far. The HBCUs mixed in with like the New York experience now, in Atlanta in particular, it's just been a journey of studying blackness, really. And my favorite hue came up as a series where I got to do that, where I got to do that from like an inspiration standpoint, where I got to do that from kind of like us in our best light standpoint. And it was fun doing that very first painting with the halo behind it, because I was very in the beginning kind of hesitant to do the posthumous, I think is how you say it, right?
Oh yeah, posthumous.
Posthumous, maybe. But the piece after he had passed away, I was hesitant to do it because I'm not really a fan of what I think is like kind of the bandwagon-y kind of RIP like portraits and stuff after people pass away, especially if it's not somebody that like I felt really connected to as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, this one was a special request, and there was a lot of like odds and ends and like meditating I had to do on it, but I really appreciated it. And I ended up doing the halo, not because he had just passed away, but there was this concept I read about like that Basquiat used to do in his paintings, where he would always either like zero in on like a skull or a head or put the crown in there to emphasize the black mind or the black intelligence or ingenuity, as opposed to like the black body, and how America has always used that as kind of the stake of our capital. So being able to like put that adornment or that crown, if you will, around the head was another situation of like representation. But now, like you just said, like me shining that light on him, like society's already seen, like this is not, it's not a hero per se. Nipsey has some complicated things that he was dealing with. He's not a role model per se, because he has some controversial opinions about different marginalized people. But all together, he was a light that helped us understand a particular story, that helped us reconcile a lot of concepts, that showed us that even through what you were just talking about, between those spectrums of like chaos and order, that there's still some part, there's some modicum of truth in there that's like moving us forward, that's showing us like here's a path that we can take that's a little bit more sustainable than what we've been doing. This thing came like full circle, because once the painting was finished, I was able to curate an exhibit at my job, actually,
employee exhibit, and I was really nervous because I had never brought any of my artwork into the office other than like passing by, going in or out of the post office. So like maybe 10 people may have seen it. So now I'm bringing a painting that, you know, my heart's invested into in the middle of like a New York finance company for public scrutiny. And it's not my peers, or at least not my cultural peers. And I was like super nervous about it, right? Because I'm like, this is not a picture of like Nipsey in a suit or anything. Like this is Nipsey. It's like a picture that I think really represents him, like a zoomed in photo, like tattoos and all, right? And I'll never forget. Like I had a coworker come up to me and said they cried when they saw it, like shed tears. I had people in the office tell me like they were shocked to walk in there and see not only a black face, but a face that they knew and recognized, that they felt was relevant to their story, especially what we were going through around the same time that Nipsey passed away. And it was just a different experience being able to like sit down and talk to, again, coworkers that were on the outside of that experience, or the outside of that story, and who had no idea. And before I knew it, like the thing just kind of kept going. Like the installation I thought was supposed to be like maybe a 3-week or 4-week situation turned into a 2.5 month long exhibit. We had a guy randomly in the office from the Financial Times, like looking for a client, and ended up seeing the installation in the building and writing about it maybe like sometime that summer of 2019. And every single time, like it came back, like I had to center back on that question or that issue or that argument within myself of like, do I pick Nipsey or do I pick somebody else? And every single time that picture got republished with like the black man with the braids, with the tattoos, I don't know, it just made me smile, to be honest.
Yeah, man. You know, this, it's a tough one, right? Like, I think that the toughness I'm describing or I'm feeling in what you're saying actually has very little to do with black representation anymore. And it has mostly to do with attachment to a self or attachment to a particular image of any self, white, black, pink, purple, red, brown, doesn't matter. And I feel that the tension most black people might feel is once they realize that they're more than just similar to the Basquiat crown, once they realize they're more than just their body, then they realize the interconnectedness between different races. Mm-hmm. And I find the toughness, maybe it's just an individualized experience or sporadic experience, and maybe it's an anomaly, but I find that the toughness is in trying to reconcile the truth of knowing that everyone's interconnected while also still acknowledging the truth of the bodily experience. Mm-hmm. And said otherwise, it could be just simplified to say that, like, once you recognize the metaphysical and the truth of quantum physics, yeah, then it's tough to bounce between the physical and the metaphysical.
Yeah.
As a black person. And even by me saying as a black person, that's immediately negating the fact that I understand metaphysics. Mm-hmm. Because white folks ain't walking around saying, as a white person, I feel this way, because yeah, it doesn't matter. Mm.
This is good. This is good. This is where I spend the 40 to 60 hours of my week now. Grappling with these types of questions or these different like thought processes, like in my diversity work. What I realized, the question that I started the work with, right, was how do I go into a company now and help them create an equitable experience for all employees, knowing that I do hold a closeness to this Black identity. When I showed the Nipsey piece, I was literally in a suit and my hair was short, and it was a, you know, nobody would have thought that I had any tattoos or anything. And it's kind of funny now, looking back on it now that I have braids and like we've been at home for like 16 months and I've been in t-shirts and stuff with my coworkers. So it was a bit of a like self-fulfilling prophecy there. But on the grander scale, just kind of like going back and forth with that idea of like, I know I have selfish interests. How do I again be unselfish and making sure that everything is more or less, again, equitable, right? And one of the thoughts that came up that was a bit, that was, I guess, reconciling in that is this idea that like all is one, and then vice versa, even the one is all. So really being able to zero into that experience of, say if we're all this collective organism, right? If we could identify a collective group of working parts that are being attacked for whatever reason, if it was an individual, we call that some type of cancer. We would call that some type of ailment. We say that there was like an acute failure of some particular organ. For an entire society, this living, breathing construct of humanity, I think the argument that we're having kind of like at a stripped away, like race, experience, agnostic, we're trying to say like, there's a way that we've been living for a while that is counterintuitive. I just finished up Bell Hooks' book, All About Love. And she really dives into this idea of like a loving community and how this ethic of love, of really, again, just appreciating the things that are around us, whether it's living or inanimate, making sure that those things are left kind of in a better place, making sure that the people around us feel supported, and if not supported, not negated, right? And it just goes on to show like, okay, we see the kind of victim in an oppressed cycle. And it seems like it's one directional, but in truth, it's a vicious cycle. Like we see these principles kind of like play out in economics, for example. Like when you have that wide wealth gap, countries and economies usually tumble right after that. But when you have that surviving, thriving like middle class, then it seems like all parties end up being equal. Hmm. So like with that individual experience, it's like, how do I use the lens that I have, right? How do I use this particular superpower of awareness to help other people understand like what Arkansas looks like, because they've been in New York their whole life, right? How do I show them what they do to people in Harlem versus how they treat people in Midtown? How do I show people that the way we speak to each other in a boardroom versus the way we speak to each other in the street, there's a difference there, right? How do we tease out those individual like systems and thought processes within people? Because again, we like to say I'm a Black person, but that's not true. It's like I'm a Black, patriarchal, educated, middle class. It's like all these different isms as we start teasing it out. It's like each one of those has, for lack of a better word, inefficiencies within it.
I love the word inefficiencies used there. I think it's like it's an accurate depiction to keep things relevant and to connect with a certain type of audience. Mm-hmm. Because the two descriptions that I love that you use, the one of the organism and an identification of a cancer, because for a long time, that is the way it's been viewed. And the best way to deal with cancer is to shock it with radiation and kill it. Mm-hmm. And slightly risk the entire organism. But at the same time, at least that's gone. And yep. For now, it seems like there's like an undercover job going on to say that like, look, man, like I can't help but think about your mentioning Harlem and showing people in Midtown what is actually going on in Harlem. Even though Harlem now is much different than Harlem in 1979 or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think those sort of undercover jobs of bringing, serving as a reporter, if you will, for that sector of reality. And I want to be conscious of time too, like I mentioned, but obviously I want to talk about this forever. And it seems that like it's worth maybe talking about your practice as an organization in itself, mm-hmm. Because a lot of times I can get tripped up and a lot of people get tripped up off of the philosophical, the joy of talking about the psychology of art, yeah. What it does to you, how it makes you feel. And at the same time, most people's art never reaches anyone. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about how you sort of organize your business of art. Yeah. What are some of the you know, just let's start there. How have you organized your business?
Yeah. I have always been at heart, like a serial entrepreneur. And I think that has always been kind of like the way I've gone about like starting new projects or starting new business ventures. I'm always very scrappy. I love a good MVP. And there's nothing wrong with like starting with what you have, right? So with art, this was just taking a step back. It always surprises people that I did not study art in college. I actually studied business. And I studied business management with the thought process that I was going to be a consultant. So I was very surprised to end up on Wall Street, very surprised to end up in finance specifically. And now that I'm doing art, it does not surprise me that I approach it like I would a business. So starting there, like I remember in 2016, when I really decided or made the mental decision to become a professional artist, the first couple of months were really just about, I think, effectiveness, really figuring out what I wanted to do, what elements I like to play with, what stories I like to tell, and really just being as free as I could be. Because I mean, art is one of those things where we say it's not science, it's art. The first thing you have to do is really just get inspired, I think. Find that question, find that rabbit or that tennis ball or whatever that you feel like you got to chase after. From there, it really just became a small but steady stream of experiments. So I go through, and I think you may remember this personally, but it's like I went through maybe a couple of years where the most consistent piece of art that I was making was bracelets. It was a small thing that I knew I could ship globally, something that I've been creative for a long time. And ultimately, I figured I could scale this to fuel a different part of my business. But once I got into that, I realized, well, I love the customization piece. I love the customer interaction, but I don't really get a lot of joy out of making hundreds. And I think that would really be where I'd love to have the value at, is like a custom jeweler that made handmade bracelets for every single person. I'm like, but thousands of bracelets, not going to happen, right?
Right.
So I switched and I started doing more paintings. And here's where things got a little unconventional, right? Once I started doing the paintings and I understood loosely how people got paid as artists in terms of like provenance, network, schooling, pedigree, things like that, I sat down and I'm like, okay, there's a part of this where, you know, I kind of already command a certain price point. I guess now it's about product market fit and really figuring out who are the people that I really need to go after in terms of creating art, right? And I had this idea, and I think I saw this on one of the questions, so I won't spoil it too much, but I started the 10,000 Paintings Project. And the people that originally reached out, it kind of correlated with like my close network of friends from undergrad, from my professional network, and people otherwise that I had started my career with. And along the way of me doing that as a social experiment, I've been able to kind of like rope off an audience that's highly engaged, highly, versed in terms of the art industry and really in tune on the political side. So it's like I end up nurturing an audience over the past like 5 years and also watching them and seeing what they did as individuals and where those markets started to emerge. So people that I met at the beginning of that project that may have been in law school are now like, you know, running their own nonprofits, for example. And I'm like, ah, that's interesting. One of the questions that was a part of that project is like, where would you put the art? I was very interested on like the storytelling aspect and like where the art would travel to. Anyway, the 10,000 projects was interesting. It goes into the practice because like those social experiments of, okay, this is how much it costs. This is how much I could actually sell the final product for. This is how I need to like find the customer. This is how I need to solve the problem in terms of commissions. It was all these things like kind of built out and me discovering my process. From like a day-to-day standpoint, I think it was about literally establishing a routine that I could be consistent with. I heard an artist and mentor say, do not discount a 15-minute working session. A lot of people feel like you need to do deep work. You need to get like an hour and a half. You got to focus for a second. But I've heard this guy, he's a musician, say that he's recorded whole albums in like consecutive 15-minute sessions. He's like, it's hard to try and find time sometimes. And, you know, 15 minutes here of like sketching, 15 minutes here of drafting, 15 minutes here of, you know, actually putting the paint on the canvas, it adds up. So like making sure that consistently every day, like I was putting canvas time in, making sure that there was some level of input and research, I think every day. As a visual artist, I feel like for me, that's pretty easy and broad. But there were some specific practices, I think, that helped supplement that. So that's like looking through images, going to museums, actually finding documentaries of artists that inspired me and learning deeply where I'm interested. But then again, just keeping an open mind, like taking those suggestions when friends tag me in new pictures or new artists or new exhibits. And then last but not least, I think kind of now, like as I'm emerging and starting to get into bigger, I guess, contracts and deals and stuff, I think that kind of came with a slow, patient, just working up the network, right? There's a lot of, as an artist, this is tough. This is very tough to like give his advice. I do not believe in being a starving artist, but I do think there's a level of intention with the storytelling that can be done. I do think there's a level of buy-in that artists have to have for their audience. Not just the customers, but again, those people who are really champion like what it is they're trying to say. And like my entire professional career as an artist has been kind of built on those key relationships, whether it's a person that put me in like a gallery show or a pop-up, or they may be a patron. It's just like really asking them. Similar to how like an Apple or an Amazon or a, you know, Microsoft would take feedback from customers and then go back and do those software upgrades, like asking them, like, where would you imagine me going? You bought the art with an appreciation lens that, you know, you liked it where it is, but at its height, where could you see it? And then leaning on, you know, some of their vision to try and push me a little bit further too.
That constant, it's interesting because science and art always seem to be so divorced from one another. And I've got a couple more questions that we could wrap, but what I heard you say, and I think a couple of things I teased out, because I never like to restate what somebody already said, this in general, just bad practice and a terrible way of listening to somebody. The things that intrigue me are this balance between science and art, because what you just did in a matter of like 5 to 7 minutes is pretty much break down what people are trying to get out of art school for 3 years. Mm-hmm. They're trying to get out what's the most important thing I need to be focused on outside of learning this skill set. Because I think the process of doing this, of starting Educated Guests as an initiative 3.5 years ago to try to help gain a personal understanding of what the world is like of art and design. And then once it clicked for me, and once patterns start to reveal themselves, start to turn that narrative in a way to teach others what is true and what's not true. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing I'm finding is that there's this sort of consecutive, there's this Venn diagram, I couldn't think of the word. There's this Venn diagram of three circles overlapping on one another. And there's what the market's telling you. Mm-hmm. There's the skill set you're trying to build. And then there's a deep expertise of a knowledge base or credentials, if you will. And I find that like a lot of focus is given to developing a deep expertise or lots of credentials, getting all these degrees. And there's a deep focus on skill set. And how many different softwares do you know? How many different painting or how many different processes do you know? And nobody pays attention to the market. Mm-hmm. Because the hope is that if you're good enough over here, people will just gravitate and go to the other circles, but that breaks the whole Venn diagram. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting to me and what you described is that you've uncovered the patterns in those three circles intersecting with one another, and you found how that works for you, and you're not shying away from your story. I think that's one of the reasons I wanted to get our conversations, which are always intriguing, on record, is because a lot of times people will shy away from their true story. Mm-hmm. And they'll identify a certain part of their story as bad and they want to hide it in a closet. And then they only want you to see what is, you know, what they want you to see. Mm-hmm. But everything they do is a caricature of the bad thing they just hid in the closet. Mm-hmm. And I'm finding the thing I love about your work is that there are no caricatures. It's just a new character being built on top of the one that was already there. Mm-hmm. But that person is still there. It's just evolved. And I'm curious, this is the last question I have. And I expect you to say something pretty remarkable, just based on how the conversation has been going so far. Is like, I ask it to everyone, if you were to sort of speak to the 17-year-old version of yourself, you know, what piece of advice would you give to him at that time, knowing what you know now?
This is probably one of the hardest, but like most consistent pieces of advice I think I give now. And I actually had a mentor at the time that used to say it all the time, and I used to just hate him because he would never really expand on it. He'd just laugh at me. But literally every response, every big question, every super ideological thought, every truism that I spit out, he just laugh and say, "Don't worry, keep living." And I just would look at him like perplexed, like, "What do you mean, keep living?" Right? If I had to think about like where I was at 17, I was like super nervous. My birthday was kind of late, so I was always like the youngest in my class. So I had just graduated. I was on my way to Morehouse, first generation college student. It was pretty scary because it wasn't just like first generation college student, but I had like older siblings and older cousins, like first cousins and stuff that had went and had already come back, right? So it just seemed like a kind of remarkable amount of pressure, but also like this big release and you know, just like things that were going on, right? And I think I may have given you this advice or some of our mutual friends this advice before, but I've seen the quote, if you're going through hard times, don't worry. It'll soon change. If you're going through good times, don't worry. This too will soon change, right? This idea that 17-year-old self, even at that point, still, I don't think was ready or understood the depths at which like things could change, right? What imagination really, what things could come to an imagination that was really like stretched out, right? What years of experience actually do to a problem, to a thought process, all of it, right? Like, we don't think about our lives in big chunks often, but if you think about like 10-year bands, right? Like where you were at the beginning of this decade, the 2010, we're like, it's a world away. When I thought about like where I was at the beginning of like the 10,000 Paintings project, again, it was a world away. And I was like 5 years. So 17-year-old self, he'd be mad. He'd be mad as hell, but I'd probably smile at him the same way my mentor did to me then and just say, don't worry, keep living, right? Take some time, enjoy it. Take it in while you're there and relish in the moments. Like not just the appreciation and the celebrating of the wins, but I think I heard Drake say, like, I wish I could go back and live it twice, not to change things, but just to, you know, learn a couple lessons twice or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, like even those bad moments where it's like, I wish I could just go back and just sit in them again. Cause like those were some of them deep, deep like revelations. I think at this point I figured out that, or at least comfortably, at least accepted the thought that it's all made up. So we could kind of just keep making it up and enjoy the show, right? And yeah, I think at 17, I was, there was so much, I think, that I was trying to just like known goals that I was trying to hit. That, yeah, if I really believe that, like, don't worry, keep living, I'm like, yeah, that might have set me at ease just a little bit. Like, all I got to do is show up, basically.
Man, that's beautiful. Is there a, I always like to leave a little opportunity for people to like share what's going on right now, things to look out for. This isn't an advertising show or per se, but I always like people to talk about, you know, where can we find you? Where can we connect with you? Like what's going on?
Yeah. Best place to connect, I think, is on Instagram. I love Instagram as a platform and as a visual artist, it's easy for me to share and storytell. But my handle is the same across all platforms. It's Rob Newman III, RobNewmanIII. In terms of things coming up, like not to get too deep into like specific projects, but this next year and a half for me, the theme in terms of artwork is really growing in that multidisciplinary stage, like really seeing what I can actually do once I start putting all these different skills together. You mentioned earlier the science and the art. I actually had an argument with a quote unquote creative. And I told them that I was an artist because artist is an actual profession. It implies inspiration. And I use the creative process. I use the scientific process. I use the Socratic process. Like I use all these different tools as an artist to get to the end. And I think this next 18 months for me is really bringing that to the forefront. So figuring out projects that bring my story fully through, figuring out projects that I get to, again, show up on a different medium. And projects where it's the same job, but a different title, basically. A few like teasers, working on a few murals and commissions for different like finance companies. I just got like this big announcement a few days ago that I just became the featured muralist for PwC. And I think that's something that's, again, projects like that, where the Wall Street artist, where the background from like the travels through Black America, the actual finance career, you know, come to life.
Hey, if you've made it this far, then it means that perhaps you were able to stick in the gauntlet of patience for long enough to get something that perhaps was looking for you in the same way that you were looking for it. You know, most people who listen all the way through these episodes perhaps are interested in something more than just a higher pay check or, you know, some job that seems to give them a cooler title, but they're not really sure what that is. And if this is your first time listening, or if it's your 200th time listening, we're indebted to you just for you lending an ear to us. Thank you for all that you do for this community, and thank you for being this community. Without you, none of this would really mean anything. So thank you for the reciprocal relationship we have, whoever you are, wherever you are. And we'll talk to you soon. Peace.